for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This episode of The Media Twits is brought to you by CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, offering an intensive, cutting-edge, three-semester Master of Arts in Journalism and a unique one-semester Advanced Certificate in Entrepreneurial Journalism, and CUNY JCamp, a series of continuing professional development workshops focused on emerging trends and skill sets in the industry. Learn more at journalism.cuny.edu. Along with Rafat Ali, it's kind of a sad day for us here at the podcast and in media land with Steve Jobs dying. Huh?
Yeah. It's been a very eventful and full of memories and all kinds of stuff over the last since last night. And you guys, it probably hit much earlier than us because you're on the West Coast. So until like 12:30 in the night, I was just reading a lot of stuff about him that I didn't even know. So I guess I never really focused on his personal life except for buying Apple products.
Yeah, it's these kind of times where you really learn a lot more about him. I mean, the New York Times came out very quickly with this great, bio kind of look back from John Markoff that had a lot of great details in it. And you know, now this Walter Isaacson biography is kind of being rushed into print. And this was kind of the authorized biography.
He did like 40 interviews, and I think that's what it said.
Yeah, and that was fascinating, especially the comment that just came out today. It was kind of an excerpt from it that said that that Steve Jobs, you know, basically the reason he was doing the biography was because I guess he wanted his kids to know him, and that his kids didn't really know him that well because would understand why he was so busy and why he was away so much, which I thought was kind of fascinating too.
Yeah, and it's already the number one book on Amazon.com, and I bought it too for my Kindle, which I'll get on October 24th now, as I'm sure a lot of other people.
So yeah, I remember. I mean, I noticed it kind of popped up on Google Plus, you know, as people talking about that Steve Jobs died, and it was, you know, at first you kind of didn't know whether you trusted what you're reading just because we've had rumors before that he was going to die and then it didn't pan out. So I think it was only until something was actually sourced to Apple or Apple posted on their website that people actually started to believe it.
Yeah, I don't really remember who broke it first, anything like that. Not that this is a news that sort of lends itself to that, but I got a text from my friend, and that's I think probably with. It was she was probably watching TV because I don't think she saw it online. I think she watched TV. It was probably CNN. Then she texted me. Then I turned on CNN through CNN International through my Roku box. So anyway, that's how I found out. And then, of course, Twitter.
Yeah. And then it really – I mean, the way it took over Twitter and Google Plus and just all the social networks and Facebook, and just seeing all the things come in. I mean, seeing what Mark Zuckerberg had to say and Bill Gates and just people that, you know, you think of as just being almost, I don't know, they're competitors, they can be enemies. We always think paint them that way, but I guess there's a lot more collegiality and a lot more friendship going on behind the scenes that I guess we don't know about.
Yeah, one of the videos to watch at some point for people who haven't watched it yet and are listening to this would be the All Things D, I think it was 2007 interview with him and Bill Gates together on stage. And I was there. I don't know if you were there, but I was there.
Yeah, I was there too.
I think I remember that. Yeah, and we were in the front row. I mean, I was literally sitting in the front row, and just a fascinating, fascinating interview with to see the these two titans of tech that we all sort of look up to. And it was an amazing interview, at least for the people who were in the room, because it may not come across that well in video, but at least for the people in the room, we sort of felt it.
So yeah, I remember asking a question to Bill Gates about making a deal with Apple. I think they had made a deal with Sun. They'd done all these things. And I said something about, you know, are you going soft by doing that? And he had some very political answer and didn't really like say anything about it, but it was kind of interesting to see them both up on stage there.
So we'll talk about Steve Jobs and just how important he's been for in the tech business as a business icon and someone who's really disrupted the media industry. We'll have special guests on Alan Deutschman, author and professor at University of Nevada, Reno. We'll also have Leander Cani on, who's runs the Cult of Mac site, has also written three books about Apple, including one about Steve Jobs. We'll talk a little bit about the announcement that Apple made with Tim Cook at the helm with the iPhone 4S. And then we'll also talk a little bit about the Amazon Kindle line of Kindles that were announced last week and just how those sales have already taken off, and what that means as far as competition between Apple and Amazon and how that's heating up. First, let's talk a little bit more about Steve Jobs, and we'll bring on we have a couple special guests. Alan Deutschman is a veteran technology journalist, having been the Silicon Valley correspondent for Fortune, senior writer at Fast Company, the Profit Motive columnist at GQ, and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and New York Magazine. He wrote the book The Second Coming of Steve Jobs and is now a professor of business journalism at the University of Nevada at Reno. Leander Caney is a technology writer and author. He's a former managing editor, previously a senior reporter at Wired News. He's the author of three books centered on the subculture around Apple products, as well as the company itself. He's written The Cult of Mac, The Cult of iPod, and Inside Steve's Brain. He's now editor and publisher of the popular Cult of Mac blog. Welcome to the show, Leander.
Thank you, Mark.
So we were just talking about just how, we heard the news that Steve Jobs had died, whether we believed it or not. I mean, my first take was just, I'm seeing it on Google Plus, do I believe the source, etc. What did it mean to you guys when you first heard the news?
Well, I got a call from CNN from a producer in New York asking if I w could make a comment. So the first thing I said was the F word. And I was a little bit, I was shocked, even though it was obvious that it was going to be sooner than later, unfortunately. From his public appearances, it shouldn't have been a surprise. And in fact, we'd sort of editorially prepared for this a little bit, probably not as much as we should have done, but it was still a shock, and hard to prepare for, even as an outside observer, let alone. I really feel bad for his family.
Yeah. What about you, Alan? How did you hear about it?
I was with my dog in the dog park and got a call on my iPhone from a local newspaper reporter here in Reno, Nevada, and he told me that it just hit the Associated Press wire. Been interviewed by major news organizations for their obituaries they had been preparing for the past 8 years since Steve first took medical leave and revealed that he had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And so we've known for a long time this was coming, but I think it's still something of a shock and hard to process.
Yeah, it seemed really, really hard to believe, hard to take. And it's hard, I think, as a journalist to have distance from from him as a subject, because he just touches our lives in so many ways. It's hard for us to kind of not feel like we were close to him, even if we weren't. You guys worked on books about him, and now we've got this book coming out that's with Walter Isaacson, that's, he's involved in that book. How does it feel for you guys just looking at that process and that book? Are you curious about what that's going to be like?
It will be interesting to see in the authorized Walter Isaacson book whether the very small circle of people who were truly close to Steve Jobs in recent years were able to talk candidly and openly, or if they were more guarded. So I think everyone is really awaiting this.
What about you, Leander? What do you think about the book and possibility of what it might reveal?
Oh, I'm hoping that it will reveal a lot. As Alan was saying, it was really difficult to get people to talk. Even, people who worked with Steve 25, 30 years ago. Steve had a long reach and a lot of power in Silicon Valley, and nobody wanted to jeopardize jeopardize that, you know, that. So, you know, it's authorized. I mean, that alone has got to be, that's a major breakthrough. He's going to get more than anybody has got previously. And I found that Jobs' interviews, they were always really fascinating because he was actually really candid and really honest. And when I had read a lot, you know, I read all the interviews of Red Allen's book and a whole bunch of others, and often sort of smaller, more subtle points that were easy to skip over the first time, you know, took on much more meaning when you sort of studied the literature, of which there isn't really that much. You know, he hasn't really talked very much about his life or his methodology. There are only scraps here and there. So I think the fact that he's collaborated with an authorized biography is a massive step forward. I mean, it's bigger than anything so to date.
Mark, I'm the author of yet another authorized book about Steve, an ebook actually that's coming out on Wednesday, October 12th.
What's the title of that one?
That is called "How Steve Jobs Changed Our World," and it's part of a longer physical book that will come out later called "Why Steve Jobs Matters." But it's this is really more of an appreciation to try to put Steve in historical context and to look at his impact and his legacy. In business and technology, but also really importantly in our overall culture, which he had tremendous impact on.
This is Rafa. A question for any of you, really. So since yesterday, we've heard a lot about the positive legacy of Steve Jobs and all that he's done. In terms of, I don't know if negative, but in terms of legacy that some of the other companies shouldn't emulate. What are some of those sort of negative legacies that you think Apple or Steve Jobs have sort of done? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the big criticisms is how closed the systems are, I guess, and that could be one of the things that he's built. But anybody.
Well, I would argue strongly that that was actually, you know, one of the best things that he did. You know, I know that it goes counter to the techno-libertarian streak, you know, that's so prevalent in the tech industry, especially amongst the sort of alpha geeks who cannot stand the idea of Jobs dictating, you know, what they can buy in the App Store and, you know, what software they can run on their iPods and iPhones. But, you know, this is the whole reason why the Apple ecosystem works so well. It's because, you know, it's locked down, and that this is the price you pay for integration. And I think we're starting to see other companies, you know, other companies are actually copying this. You know, I mean, Microsoft definitely gave it a college try with the Zune, you know, when they brought that in-house. And Google may be trying this with Motorola. You know, there's a lot of speculation that that's the reason why they got Motorola, because, you know, this stuff, if one company can control the whole experience, it's a lot smoother, you know. And the classic example is when, you know, you get a new Dell and something goes wrong and you phone Microsoft, and Microsoft says, "Oh, it's not our fault, you know, it's the hardware." Phone Dell. You phone Dell, they say, "Oh, it's not our problem, it's Microsoft software." And the consumer is stuck in the middle. You know, it works well for consumers when there's one company in charge.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things, I always heard that there was this, you know, from journalists that talked to Steve Jobs that, you know, he was famously would get upset at a question and just kind of walk away. And there was times where he just kind of bristled, and, you know, some employees were, you know, were in fear of him, whether it's getting in the elevator with him and having to tell him something. I mean, there are a lot of people, I think, with someone that has that strong of a personality, it's hard for there not to be so many enemies and so many people that, you know, don't like him or don't believe his methods, you know, are worth it. And then there's always, you know, you look online at all these, you know, anytime someone puts some kind of tribute to him or says how much they care about him, there seems like there's always a comment that comes up first saying, you know, "Good riddance," and "We don't need him anymore." And I mean, there's this very polarity that happens where people just, you know, it's the Mac versus PC stuff. All that seems to still exist. And I mean, just the fact that you've got a site called Cult of Mac, Leander, I mean, that really kind of sums up. It's that cult-like thing where people just love it or hate it.
Yeah, it's like too. Yeah, there's definitely that polarity. I mean, people do love that. These are very personal devices. People really fall in love with them, and will support the platform, you know, to irrational lengths. But you know, everyone. One of the things that I never really got to the heart of when I was talking to people who work for Steve. I mean, everyone had a Steve Jobs yelled in my face story. But you know, one of the things that has marked his career are these long collaborations. I mean, he's worked with Johnny Ive for more than 14 years, 15 years, and Phil Schiller, you know, for a long time too. And you know, maybe those guys can take that, and you know, it doesn't let them bother them. But I get the feeling, I get the impression that, you know, that he doesn't yell at those guys that much, or if he does, you know, it's not personal, and it's just a way of sort of getting to the bottom of the argument. I talked to John Rubinstein, and you know, he told me that he was yelled at by Jobs plenty of times, but he would just sort of let it roll off his back. And I think more often than not, he got a kick out of Jobs' enthusiasm for the stuff that he did well, and for the products they were creating. You know, he told me it was a really invigorating time he spent with Jobs. You know, they were moving really fast and they were having a lot of fun.
I think the people who, if I can add to that, I think the people who worked best with Steve Jobs. Because Steve Jobs would subject his people to tirades, to verbal abuse, as part of his passionate, relentless pursuit of perfection. He could really yell and scream at people and be very harsh in his language and his judgment. And the people who worked best with him would either let it roll of them, or they could give it right back to him. And Steve Jobs really liked it. He denigrated your work, and then you stood up for your, and you really kind of gave it right back to him, because it showed that you were passionate about what you were doing, and you believed in what you were doing, and you weren't going to be put down by his criticism because you had such strong conviction in your work. That's really what he wanted to see among his colleagues as they worked with him in this pursuit of greatness. So, you know, it was tough to work with him because he was really demanding of himself and others. And the people who did manage to successfully work with Steve Jobs over the years had different strategies of responding to that very forceful personality.
Right. Bill Gates used a similar strategy at Microsoft too. I mean, meetings are often sort of trials by fire. And he justified it by saying that it was the quickest way to get to the bottom of an argument. It was the quickest way to find out. Someone would stick up and fight for what they were presenting. Then you knew that they believed in it and they probably were right.
So where does this leave Tim Cook? He's the new CEO at Apple. He just presided over this announcement about the iPhone 4S. You know, it seems like he's in a very difficult position on one hand, just because he's going to have to follow after, you know, one of the greatest business leaders in American history, and yet he also has the advantage of having worked with Steve Jobs for so long and having, you know, really helped run the company in so many different ways. So it feels like it's a little bit of a mixed bag for him, a real challenge, but yet he does have the advantage of having been there for a long time.
That's true. I mean, no one has worked more closely with Steve Jobs or had more of a chance to, you know, to see up close the workings of Steve Jobs' mind, his method, his technique, than Tim Cook. You know, if anyone's had the opportunity to do a Vulcan mind meld with Steve Jobs, it's been Tim Cook. But if I can carry on the Star Trek metaphor, the issue is, I think Cook is really seen as Mr. Spock rather than Captain Kirk. Cook is the kind of expert at efficiency and operations and all the kind of behind the scenes logistics, and you know, the question that everyone is waiting to see is whether Cook can have the charisma and the gut instinct and the extraordinary risk taking that really characterized Steve Jobs' success.
Right. Yeah, that's an excellent analogy, Alan. You know, Cook's an unknown quantity. No one knows what his instincts are like, but and of course, you know, I think Apple's success over these last 14 years has almost been as much to do with Cook as Jobs, at least in terms of you know, being able to deliver the products in these massive quantities. But Cook has a design background. He studied design at college, and you know, the team that came up with the hardware and the software remains at Apple. You know, Johnny Ive and Scott Forstall and all the others on the executive team, they're still there. They're still working together in the same way. You know, if you take Jobs out of the equation, will things change really dramatically? I mean, one of the things I like to hear over the last few years were the times when Jobs was wrong. He was dead set against the App Store for a start. He fought against that for a long time until he was convinced by, you know, people internally, but also by the clamoring of the app developers that this is something that they should do. And it's nice to sort of see that because, you know, then it punches this, you know, this sort of great man myth, and makes Jobs a lot more human, you know, and able to make mistakes.
Why was he against the App Store? Was it just because he didn't want that many outside people involved in what ran on his machines?
Right, absolutely. He didn't want it to be compromised by third party software.
Do you think the hold that he had on media CEOs, really, when he wanted to get the terms that he wanted, whether actually not just media but also sort of wireless and tech as well, the terms that he got for, let's say, from the music industry or from the movie industry or really any of the media companies, by the sheer force of his personality, I mean, he probably badgered them personally to give the terms that he wanted. Him not being there, do you think that's going to change?
It's hard to say. I don't know if anyone knows a lot about all the different dealings that went on behind the scenes. The music companies, you know, opened up their catalogs to Apple because it was a tiny little company and it was seen as a low-risk experiment to give iTunes access to their catalogs. I mean, they were getting killed by Napster and the file-sharing networks, and one of the reasons they went with the Mac, with Steve Jobs and the Mac, is because they felt that the Mac platform wasn't participating in the free-for-all on Napster at the time. They were wrong about that, but you know, they thought it was a safe island where they could experiment with this, you know, this sort of new store, and it seemed like a good idea. They could do it for a dollar. Jobs was offering really good terms, and it was seen as a limited experiment where, you know, where very little could go wrong if it did go wrong. And then, of course, it grew into a juggernaut, and then Jobs, you know, had them by the short and curlies. I think, you know, but Eddie Q apparently has been negotiating a lot of deals recently for the company. But I think, you know, if anything went wrong, they could use Jobs as this, you know, the monster in the cupboard that they could unleash if they didn't get the terms they wanted. That's how I understand it anyway. And of course, in the movie industry, because of Pixar, and because he was sitting on the board at Disney and ABC, and you know, therefore he had fingers in the pies at ABC. You know, he had a lot of connections on the movie side, so he might have used, you know, a little bit of grease there.
I think that's a very good analysis of the negotiations in the music business. With Jobs's negotiating role in the book industry, it was very different, though, because, and so Jobs was able to come and be something of a white knight to by providing a rival, a viable, you know, counter balance to the power of Amazon. He was able to give the book publishers the terms that they wanted, that made them more comfortable for embracing the ebook and e-reader market. So that it's interesting that Jobs, you know, came in and very shrewdly read the dynamics of that business and took a whole different approach, coming in as a latecomer, actually. Whereas in music, he was the leader and the innovator. In books, he was really the company that was keeping the leader, you know, honest and providing a check on the leader's power, which is really still the position Apple is playing at the moment.
Although now there is a lawsuit against Apple and the book publishers for kind of trying to set prices in the ebook industry. That's kind of a pending lawsuit.
That's right.
What do you guys think about the, or Leander especially, what did you think about what the announcement that Tim Cook with the iPhone 4S? A lot of people are saying that it was kind of underwhelming. The one thing I thought that was pretty interesting about it was the price, an incredible low price that now, you know, you can get an iPhone for free. I mean, that seems like that could be a real game changer in some ways.
Right. They're doing exactly what they did with the iPod lineup, which is diversifying it and bringing the prices down and trying to make sure that there's an iPhone for every price, for every pocketbook. It was amazing because Tim Cook managed to turn what I think is a really nice upgrade, a really nice piece of technology into something that was really, pretty underwhelming and dull.
What, you think Tim Cook played a role in that in some way, or just because he's not the most exciting person?
The thing that was so enjoyable about Jobs' keynotes is how much he geeked out about the technology. You know, I mean, he was so delighted. He was squirming with excitement. He was almost, working his way out of his pants about things like iPhoto. You know, I remember seeing him do a demo of iPhoto, and I furrowed my brow. I'm like, what is he? He must be crazy. But he was really, really geeking out about it. And then, and then things like the iPhone and new Macs, he was really delighted. He really got a kick out of this stuff. He's Apple's, primary fanboy. And the way that he acted during his keynote presentations, getting so excited about these new products, was so infectious. I mean, this they would guarantee the lines around the block at the stores, a couple of weeks later, because his excitement was so catching. I mean, people were he was just like, all the fanboys around the world. And Cook, totally killed that. I mean, he had none of that enthusiasm. He had none of that excitement. Of course, he might not have known what was yesterday was must. I mean, sorry, that 2 days ago must have been a very difficult time for him. He must have known what was going on with Steve. There was an empty seat in the auditorium for him, and it was his first one. He hasn't done this before, so there was a lot of he might have felt nervous. So they're very big shoes to fill, but. This is the great thing about Steve that he was so into his own technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think Steve Jobs' track record of doing these product launches has given us such a sense of anticipation that every time Apple does a launch, it's going to be so exciting that it's really made it hard to live up to that. I think part of the problem with this last iPhone announcement was Warren Buffett has a saying that if you want to throw a rock concert, that's good, and if you want to throw a ballet, that's good, but you don't put on a ballet and call it a rock concert. And I think that a lot of people were hoping that this would be a bigger leap forward, and what Apple had was a really good upgrade.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, all right, guys. Thanks a lot. Right,
thanks, guys.
Bye.
So I guess the last thing we can talk about is the Amazon announcement. We were off last week for Rosh Hashanah, but, Amazon had their big announcement, and a lot of people were saying that they almost kind of stole the thunder for Apple with their new line of Kindles and the Kindle Fire tablet, the Android tablet that everyone had been kind of expecting. It seems like already some of the sales numbers are leaking out and showing that, the Kindle Fire could end up being, kind of surpassing the iPad in a way. I mean, which number-wise isn't surprising. It's a lot cheaper, so it seems like more of a mass market type of tablet.
Yeah, I mean, I already ordered as well, so I have absolutely no use for it, but I still ordered.
No use? Just because everything's on, you could do on the iPad.
Meaning, like, I have, and it's not like I don't have enough devices in my life. But we ordered it. I think I'm a huge Amazon fan. I ordered literally everything from Amazon, everything you can think of. And that's why, and I use Kindle on a daily basis as well. So I think it's just, that's kind of a no-brainer for me. I'm guessing that a lot of stuff that you couldn't do in Amazon apps on Apple platforms, you can now would be able to very easily do in an on the Kindle Fire. So
yeah, and I mean, one of the things about it that people have kind of been in a way, you know, having this kind of dual thought of, you know, Amazon is creating a kind of a closed, more custom version of Android, where, you know, all their stuff is being highlighted and other things are probably not going to be highlighted. It seems like it's an even more closed system than the iPad in a way. But you know, what do you think about that? I mean, maybe it's something that consumers want in a way, just to have a very simple, easy experience that works really well.
I think that's why Kindle works. I mean, it is a very closed environment. I mean, even more closed than Apple environments, the Kindle device itself. But I mean, it can hardly do other stuff from Amazon beyond just read books and download books. But I think that the simplicity of the experience, where I call Kindle my peaceful device. So I'm hoping that Kindle Fire is probably in a similar vein that they're going to make, even though, of course, they will probably have access to the Android store. But a lot of it will be preloaded with all the stuff from Amazon. So, I think the simplicity of it and the price point and Amazon's muscle in terms of marketing online, which is probably second only to Apple, will surely be put to use here.
Now, you call it a peaceful device. Some of the cheaper versions of it, I guess, are kind of ad-supported, which I think is really interesting, that those are kind of the most popular versions of the Kindle. I mean, is that something – and I noticed that some of the MediaShift readers were saying, you know, they'd rather pay more money to not have advertising. You know, what do you think about the way they're trying to kind of put advertising on the devices?
Yeah, actually, I should just reverse the question and put it to you, but only because I have no idea how the ads show up. So –
yeah, I think it's the screensaver mode, I think, is the way they show up. I don't think they show up in a way that's super super annoying. But I think it's, you know, you've seen when it's a screensaver,
yeah,
on your Kindle,
of course, yeah.
Then they would show ads during those kinds of points.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't seem too intrusive, I suppose. If it's similar to what apps, like apps have that banner at the bottom of the screen, I'm guessing it's not that. Or if it's not that, then it doesn't seem too intrusive. But would it bother you enough that you would pay extra for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would probably pay to not have ads, just because whatever the experience is now. You just assume whenever it comes to advertising that, you know, if it's not intrusive enough, it's probably not going to make enough money. And, you know, the more intrusive it is, probably the more it would bring in for Amazon. So over time, I would think that would have to get a little bit more intrusive.
Yeah, I think so. There will probably be – it's kind of like what other social networks started completely clean and now they're plastered with ads. I think Kindle will probably go through that similar phase. Of course, Kindle has the – Amazon has the advantage of being able to sell them a lot of stuff. So with Kindle Fire, from other – besides just the books. So I think compared to just the pure Kindle, where you can only buy books and printed material, magazines and newspapers, on Kindle Fire you can buy anything from Amazon, which makes their need for advertising that much more less compared to anybody else.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with Rafat Ali, the co-host. We want to thank our guests, Alan Deutschman, as well as Leander Caney. And we also want to thank our sponsor, the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, and PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to check out all the polls, events, and news over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site IdeaLab at pbs.org/IdeaLab. We'll catch you next week.
See the haze. time.